First up today, we have a public hearing on House Bill 2296. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2296 and invite Raquel Rancière and Chris Bird up.
Thank you, Chair Helm and members of the committee. For the record, Raquel Rancière, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2296 and more specifically the -1 amendments that just came in today. This bill will help the Oregon Water Resources Department protect groundwater resources in the state as well as those users that rely on those resources. Specifically, the Oregon Water Resources Department, we are charged with overseeing well construction standards, licensing well drillers, inspecting wells, and other activities that are associated with well drilling. A little background is that this is really an important program for us, in part because poorly constructed wells can lead to local groundwater contamination. In addition, it can also result in commingling of aquifers, where you have an upper-level aquifer that drains in to lower-level aquifers, and as a result, those individuals that are relying on that upper aquifer will see groundwater level declines or result in pressure. So this is an important program, and today we're specifically going to talk about two changes to this program, and this is under the -1 amendments. You'll note that our written testimony was previously submitted on the introduced version of the bill. We did see the Oregon Groundwater Association's comments and have since spoken with them and I believe come to an agreement, and I believe Jerry will be here to talk about that. So as a result of that, we do have the -1 version of the bill, which takes out essentially Section 2. And so I won't spend time. That provision is around special standards, and I won't spend time talking about that today. But we'll talk about the two remaining components of the bill that's left with the -1 amendments. So the first part of that relates to landowner permit applications. In Oregon, it is legal to drill or construct your own well here in Oregon on your own property without the expertise of a licensed well driller. These individuals that choose to do this with this specifically applies when they're using a well drilling machine. To do this, they must submit a landowner permit application along with a $25 fee. This fee has not been increased since the 1980s and does not come close to even recuperating really a portion of the costs associated with this activity. So the total cost we estimate is around $500 to about $3,000 in staff time that's associated with assisting these landowners and ensuring that they're properly constructing these wells. As a result, we're proposing today to increase that fee from $25 to $500 to recuperate essentially the minimum costs associated with assisting these landowners that choose to do these activities on their own instead of using a licensed well driller. In addition, we're also proposing that individuals that use not just a well drilling machine, but choose to dig their own well using hand tools, that they also are required to submit this landowner permit application. The second component of this bill is in regards to bonding requirements. So when an individual through the landowner permit application process or a well driller, they are required to obtain a bond, and that's associated with being able to address any repairs as a result of a misconstructed well. That bond for a landowner permit applicant is currently $5,000, and for a well driller is $10,000. Again, that's not really sufficient to cover the costs associated with repairing a misconstructed well. So today we're proposing to increase that bonding requirement from $5,000 for the landowner applicant up to $10,000, and for the well driller from $10,000 to $20,000. So the bond paperwork is held by the state, but the money for the bonds is actually paid to a private bonding company, and either the landowner or the individual that's affected by the misconstructed well or the department can call on that bond. The bond's for a period of 3 years, and the cost associated with bond is $10 per $1,000. So today that means that a landowner is, and there's a $100 minimum, and this is an annual, so the bonds are 3 years. So today, a landowner is paying essentially $100 for $5,000 of coverage because of that $100 minimum. We're proposing to increase it to $10,000. That means it doesn't change the cost, the annual cost for the landowner. On the well driller side, it will increase their cost by $100 per year for the bonding because we're proposing to increase it from $10,000 to $20,000. So with that, we think these are small incremental changes that will help us to continue to protect the groundwater resources and those individuals that are relying on those resources here in Oregon. And we're happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Chris, did you have any testimony, or are you here for questions?
I'm here for questions, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Chris, can we get you on the record with your full name?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, my name is Chris Bird. I'm the manager of the Well Construction and Compliance section at the department.
Any questions, committee? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a historical... the actual cost that the department is incurring as a result of some of these, so we can, if we go home, we have to explain to somebody that these fees went up. They're instantly going to say, well, it never cost them that much. So, and you've talked about a number of different fees, but share a few so that we have some support for voting in favor of such an increase.
Yeah, Chair Helm and Representative Bentz. So the costs associated with the landowner permit application, we've estimated that it ranges between $500 in staff time up to about $3,000 in staff time. Today, the cost permit application fee is $25. So for that proposal, those are the estimates based on the range of staff time that we've seen. On the bonding proposal, are you asking questions about what the typical cost of repairs are, or?
No, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Before
you go to the bond, the $500 to $3,000, what is staff actually doing to generate that kind of a bill?
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, this includes reviewing the application for completeness, verifying ownership and location information for the proposed well, reviewing the well construction diagram. It also includes verifying the site conditions, writing the permit and helping them fill out the associated paperwork, visiting the site as they progress, and then also observing the seal placement, doing a final inspection, and then creating that final file.
And the final file. Thank you. So, in this, if they had contracted to have the well dug, the bill that would have been paid by the contractor is how much for the similar service?
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, it's going to vary based on the well. So some of the estimates that I had from staff on the costs associated with constructing a well, it can vary anywhere from, if it's a domestic well, around $15,000. If it's a deep irrigation basalt well, it could be around $180,000. So it's going to vary based on the actual work that's done.
I'm happy for that information for my follow-up. But that was, I meant to ask the question differently. What I was trying to do is get a comparison between the amount that you would pay if you dug your own well, mm-hmm. as compared to what you would have paid had you hired somebody to dig it for you. And by the amount I'm talking about, it's not the cost of digging the well, it's the fee. Mm-hmm. So the fee you now would pay if you're going to dig the well, if this passed, is $600, $500, I didn't write it down, a bunch, would you have paid the same amount to your contractor if you'd had a contractor dig the well and then they would have turned around the contractor and handed it to the department?
Chair Helm, Representative Bence, I'll have to get back to you on that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the fees, the only fee that's different is the $500. A landowner would pay the landowner permit application fee, which is the $500. They'd also have to pay a start card, which is $225. The driller would also have to pay that. The landowner would have to get a bond for landowner permit. The driller has their own bond. So the only difference is the, you know, the $500 plus, you know, the landowner would have to get a bond for their own permit.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
Let me get at the same set of information in a slightly different way. You described pretty thoroughly what you would do with a landowner who was going to drill his own well. What would you be doing with a licensed well driller in terms of the same set of issues? In terms of staff time and effort and that kind of thing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. Since the driller is licensed to construct wells in Oregon, they're knowledgeable of the standards. The driller takes care of ensuring they meet setbacks, verifying the well is constructed to state standards, paying all the fees. The driller is responsible for submitting the final report, whereas if a landowner drilled it, they would have to file their own report. Driller takes care of bonding. All the owner has to do in that case is hire a driller. The driller is responsible to meet standards, and the landowner would just have to pay the driller.
Yeah, a follow-up if I could. Follow-up. Yeah, the response earlier was to what the department had to do in connection with the owner constructing his own well. What does the department have to do in connection with a licensed well driller drilling a well? It's a different than, I like the answer you gave me, but it wasn't the question I thought I was asking.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. So in that case, the driller submits a $225 start card, and the department has well inspectors, and we go out and inspect at least 25% of new wells. So, you know, the inspector would probably, well, there's potential the inspector would inspect that well. There's nothing extra that would be required from the department in that case.
Thanks. So. And then Final follow-up. Is it fair to say that you're likely to inspect more of the wells drilled by an owner who didn't use a licensed well driller than of wells drilled by a licensed well driller?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's absolutely right. We put a lot of staff time into inspecting landowner wells. We're physically on site when they're placing an annular seal, which keeps contamination from contaminating the aquifer. We generally work with them. We almost have to tutor them on how to construct well properly. There's a great deal of staff time that goes into to a landowner permitted well, and we're there every step of the way. And generally, these aren't done in a day.
No.
Landowners, you know, take quite a bit of time to do these. They'll do them on weekends, after work, you know, their free time. So it could be months, could be years. You know, it just really depends on how long it takes them to complete the wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these circumstances do you, on average, encounter in a year? I would guess it's fairly rare, but on a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there's approximately 29 on average a year that get constructed by landowners.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. I guess my only apprehension would be if other... permitting and or regulatory agencies would pursue the same strategy that you're outlining here. I would just say, as an example, if somebody wants to perform their own electrical service on their home, they can do that now. And it obviously it involves more hands-on work on the part of whoever it is that's overseeing that. Or if you want to do your own construction on your home, you can obtain your own building permit, but the building department doesn't cost you more and charge you more for that permit versus what they would a licensed general contractor. So I just would throw that out there for us to consider as well. I would hope we wouldn't see a whole raft of these coming at us asking for more fees just because of agencies who are, you know, are there to regulate. I get that. There's pros and cons to that too. but just keep that into perspective. So I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. So I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more person that wants to testify. Jerry Schmidt. Schmidt. Did I get that right? No. Okay. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. That's the men and women involved in protecting and producing groundwater for our various clients. You've had testimony here prior to people representing clients showing that, in fact, they're a major part of our economy. Realize that we service all these folks, whether it's an ag user, whether it's a municipality. We even drill wells and have in the past for the conservation folks. We've drilled wells for stream temperature to augment fish flow. So we cover the whole gamut here. And what we try to do is be a party that we reach across multiple lines because we're responsible to multiple parties. I want to commend the department. The department's been very good about working with us. We both have the same objective, trying to protect the state's groundwater and still have production to the maximum use that we can have without drawing down the aquifers to some type of critical level. And they were very helpful with me trying to understand some of our concerns, and we're now in total support of what they're trying to accomplish. I think I produced to you in previous testimony some suggested figures about where the landowner's cost actually fall to the department. I was trying to show you that actually they're trying to be very beneficial, that in fact, if you go to a 50% cut, it's even higher than what they're projecting. So I commend them at trying to come to a level that's, and I understand Representative Johnson's point about homeowners being able to do things, because that's, I think that's a fundamental right. It's just something I believe in. And we try to do that in this case where you've got a resource that if something's constructed improperly, it affects everybody. It just doesn't affect you. So we're strongly trying to make a happy medium here to make it work for everybody. And I thank the department for their time and trying to work with you and working with us in the committee. So thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you all in the future.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Schmidt? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reflecting on some of the well disasters that people had to go back in and try to fix after all went south. The bond amount, that increase seemed to be extremely reasonable. Is that a correct statement or not?
Representative Benz, Chair Helm, the question is the bond amount adequate to protect to actually reflect about what the average cost might be to make the repair? By and large, the repairs could probably easily exceed $10,000 per well. I think the department was trying to be reasonable at reaching a level here for the private landowner. Obviously, if there's probably a problem here, what will happen is they'll have to bring in a licensed driller to fix it, and it probably will exceed that. That would be my likelihood, but I would concur with their idea that they're trying to keep the costs as low as they can and be cognizant of not hitting the individual property owner any harder than possible. So I commend them for that. But I guess to answer your question, more than likely it might exceed that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you. Let me ask the other question. The bill raises the other bond, a surety bond or letter of credit, from $10,000 to $20,000.
For the license, Joe.
Exactly. Using your words, is that also a very reasonable amount? I think what you were implying when you used the term very reasonable was that it's low. And I'm wondering if this is also, even with the doubling of it, it's also still low, isn't it?
Representative Barnhart, Chair Helm, to answer the question, is that figure for a licensed driller probably low? Yes. I agree.
Even the increase?
Part of the problem for a licensed driller, as opposed to a homeowner, he may be responsible for multiple wells.
Yeah, exactly.
So we could easily extend it. The difference is that the department has other tools in their box to fix it, pulling a license, making a fine. They have lots of other opportunities, but you're right. That is correct. I think that's a good assumption.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And that is all the testimony that we have for that bill today. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2296. And at this time, I'm going to push ahead a public hearing on House Bill 2343. So, Andy, if you could come up. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2343. And, Andy, just so you know, we're trying to have a public hearing on House Bill 2746 at a time that's convenient for Representative Leininger to give the kickoff. And she's available at 3:30, so I may end up interrupting you and suspending the hearing briefly to get that testimony. Then we'll get right back to you. So go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation at the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'm here to ask for your support for House Bill 2343. This bill would create a new framework for a state of Oregon biennial energy report, and it would replace the existing statutory requirement for a biennial energy plan that was adopted in the 1970s. The bill would repeal the two existing statutes that require the department to prepare a biennial energy plan and forecast, ORS 469.060 and ORS 469.070. These functions are largely provided now by utilities and by regional planning bodies and also by federal agencies, certainly with a lot of input from the department and from other stakeholders, but there's no longer a need for the department to create these independently because these plans and forecasts are created by others on a regional basis. So in place of the biennial energy plan and forecast, this bill would direct the department to produce a biennial energy report. And the report would be designed to provide timely information that would provide a foundation for decision making about energy issues that you will be facing. And it would cover all fuels, it would cover all energy resources, it would look across utility jurisdictions, and it would also consider the Oregon implications of regional and national plans. And the end result would be a synthesis or a report that would provide energy data that would be comprehensive for Oregon. And in addition to providing a synthesis of this, of all of this information and a boiling down of what's really important for Oregon, we're also envisioning that the report would include an analysis, a detailed analysis of relevant topics that we would select in consultation with you and with stakeholders and energy suppliers so that you would have the information that you need in advance of the legislative session. So the report would be submitted at the end of the even-numbered year in advance of the odd-numbered legislative session. By way of background, the original statutes were adopted in the 1970s when we were facing an energy crisis. At that time, some of us here are old enough to remember lines at the gas stations and rising gas prices, even rationing in some cases for gasoline. We had demand for electricity that was growing rapidly, and utilities were planning to build or building large energy facilities. So the legislature responded in part by directing the department to create this plan and forecast. The statutes have been amended several times since the 1970s, but the basic framework has remained the same. The department is directed to research energy prices, identify existing energy resources, estimate future supply and demand, and look at the effects of conservation on the potential future demand for energy. But as I mentioned, these energy plans and forecasts are now provided by other regional bodies. In particular, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council produces a comprehensive energy plan for electricity that looks out over a 20-year period and is updated every 5 years. And it's prepared on a regional basis with a very large stakeholder process. Utilities prepare integrated resource plans, which look across their entire system. And also the Federal Energy Information Administration provides fairly comprehensive data on a national basis, including data about Oregon. So with all these planning efforts and forecasting efforts, it's somewhat duplicative for the department to attempt to also do the same thing. But where we can really add value is to synthesize this information and turn it into something that's more useful from an Oregon perspective, pulling the Oregon elements out of these regional plans, out of the national data, looking across the utility jurisdictions, and giving you a comprehensive look for all types of fuels, not just electricity, but natural gas, coal, biomass, renewable energy, all types of energy. And provide that information in a form that will be useful to you as you're making energy decisions. So we would include information about energy consumption, generation, transmission, production, energy costs, markets, and technologies. We would also provide information about energy efficiency, greenhouse gas emissions, regulations, opportunities, challenges, and potentially recommendations. For example, recommendations on energy efficiency, on renewable energy, for research or for pilot projects. And then in addition, we would have topics that we would provide expanded analysis on which we would provide expanded analysis that we would select in conversation with stakeholders. So, for example, the report could provide a highlight on community renewables, research on emerging technologies, energy resiliency, energy storage, energy imbalance markets, best practices for energy-intensive industries, energy codes and standards, smart grid, utility peak capacity needs, and other topics that we know in consultation with stakeholders that you may be discussing in the upcoming session. So we would compile this information from published data sources, from information that we already have available to us in the course of our other duties, or additional information that we could require to be reported to us by rule if it was needed for the report. And we would also ask other agencies that have relevant data to work with us and provide that data. And we don't anticipate that this would create any fiscal impact on those agencies because we'd be asking them for information that they have readily available that we know they're working on. So in summary, House Bill 2343 would update our existing biennial energy plan statutes and create a new biennial energy report that would provide timely information on topics of the day. And we ask for your support of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions, committee? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Andy, thank you for all your work on this. One of the things that I look at when I look at these proposed plans is who's going to use the data, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you did that in trying to figure out what it was that the plan would address. But one of the things I've noticed we can't seem to put our hands on is the capacity of our transmission systems and the available amount of space on those wires that might attract somebody to install, let's say, a solar farm in eastern Oregon. Would this plan address the capacity in our transmission systems in a way that would be helpful to those that want to develop such a thing?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, it certainly could. We don't have that information readily available to us right now, although utilities have that information. And so it's the type of information, if we identified that was a need, that we could develop and make available in the report that would be issued, the next report that would be issued.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
It's a need. I'm telling you, it's a need. It needs to be in the report. And I know that because I've had, I'm going to say, a dozen different people who are interested in putting solar farms in say they can't find out how much capacity there is on the wire. They can't get it from the utilities because they won't share it. So I'm asking you, can you make sure it's in the report?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, this bill would give us the authority to request that information or to require that information to be reported to us, and we could include it in the report.
follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Yeah, you could include it. Here's what I'm trying to say. If I'm going to support this bill, there's got to be something in it that's of use to people out in the state. Just another report reciting stuff we can Google is not going to be helpful, and we're going to be wasting our money. So what I would be very interested in is a list of things that you've heard questions about that you know you have to answer, not just general statements about how valuable this is going to be to whoever might choose to peruse it on a rainy Sunday afternoon. I mean, this has to have value. So what I'm trying to tell you is having a measure of the capacity in our transmission systems would have a value. Please put that on the list. And then if you need to address it to whoever may be in charge of that department, I'm hoping ultimately this year it's going to be a commission. We can perhaps present that to that group if we end up having a commission for the department. But I want to get that oar in the water right now.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I know there's been a lot of discussion about the department over the interim and so forth. I know there's been a work group actively looking at the department, what could be changed and so forth. And I just want, you know, this to me seems like kind of almost a reinvention of, you know, what the department's about and their role and responsibilities. And I just wonder how that process influenced this, or if was this at all discussed. We have a couple of members here on the dais who, you know, participated in that work group and so forth. Or is this just something the department has kind of crafted on its own and so forth? Because it does seem a little bit like mission creep to me. I just want to ensure that, you know, if we go this direction, there's been some vetting of what's being suggested here and the new role for the department.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, we really consider the function of providing credible, independent data on energy to be a core mission of the department. I think that's consistent with our organizing statutes. What we're really looking for with this bill is to make this report more useful. Back in 1975, when these statutes were adopted, no body was other than ODO was doing this work, and now there's a lot of regional planning happening. But what's missing, and what we're told, we've been told by our stakeholders, is that the report is no longer relevant because it doesn't address the kinds of information that Representative Benz was talking about and other types of information that people need to make decisions. And it just is a repetition of information that's otherwise available. So what we're trying to do is really tailor this to make it useful for our stakeholders. And the way we would do that is by In the process of each biennium, as we were beginning to put the report together, we would actually reach out to all of our stakeholders, and we would also reach out to you and ask what types of information do you need, what topics should we really highlight in this upcoming report so that you have it available.
We can follow up. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you very much.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2243. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2746 and invite Representative Leininger to introduce the bill. Thank you for being here today and taking time out of your other committee.
Thank you, Chair Helm and members of the committee. I'm Representative Ann Leininger from House District 38, Lake Oswego, Southwest Portland, and I'm pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2746. Which is the bottle bill transition fix. As you know, on April 1st, 2017, Oregon's going to transition from a 5-cent bottle deposit rate to a 10-cent bottle deposit rate for qualifying beverage containers, and it's the product of a long-standing commitment and negotiated agreement for how we will handle deposits. But distributors and retailers and consumers need some clarity on how this is going to be rolled out, how the transition will take place. And so what House Bill 2746 does is clarifies that regardless of how containers are labeled, up until March 31st, 2017, they will be redeemable for 5 cents. And then starting April 1st, 2017, they'll be redeemable for 10 cents. And this will ease the administration and the implementation of an agreement that was made previously. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the team that can speak to details and answer more of your questions. But I want to note that it's time sensitive because April 1st is fast approaching, and we look forward to your consideration and hopefully support for this bill right away. And with that, I'll turn it over to the team that will speak to it more closely.
Very good.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. And so, committee, that April, the goal of this bill, if it's acceptable to folks, that April 1st date is also a target for the legislature completing its work on the bill and the governor signing it so that it is clear. So that's we have the topical question in front of us and the scheduling question, too. So thank you again. And I'll invite up Paul Romaine, Jesse Sweet, and Brian.
Detention.
Come on up, Brian. We'll get you all at the same time. And Mr. Romaine, why don't you lead off?
Paul is going to do cleanup, but if you want.
If you already have a set order, go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Helm and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm the Director of Administrative Policy and Process for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I've submitted written testimony, so I'll be brief in my remarks. The OLCC does not take a position on this bill. However, the bill does address a key requirement in the agency's administration of Oregon's bottle bill. The OLCC is the administrative agency tasked with enforcing the terms of the bottle bill and administering it. We work with distributors, retailers, redemption centers, and consumers to make sure that they're complying with state law. However, I'd like to note that the agency does not play a role in setting policy around the bottle bill, and we have very limited authority to adopt administrative rules under the bottle bill. As was previously discussed, the redemption value on containers will increase from 5 cents to 10 cents beginning on April 1st. This is a feature of the statutes which required the agency to make a determination on refund values. If those refund values were under 80%, the increase was triggered. And that increase, again, is effective April 1st, 2017. There is another change that is coming to the bottle bill on January 1st, 2018. This, again, is statutory, and there will be additional containers included in the bottle bill on that date. Essentially, every beverage container except for distilled spirits, wine, milk, and infant formula will be included in the bottle bill on that January date. So this bill before you today, addresses both of these changes by creating a grace period for labeling of containers. It does not change the underlying deposit value, and I feel it will provide industry stakeholders some necessary flexibility in meeting these requirements. That concludes my remarks.
I think maybe we'll hold questions till the end of the panel.
Yeah, good idea.
Chair Helm and members of the committee, my name is Brian Butenchin, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild, and we strongly support the fix that is House Bill 2746. And thank you very much. Short and sweet.
That's the kind of testimony we like.
You've got a future. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland and representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We, too, support the bill. Really, what's happened is the OLCC has been incredibly flexible in working with us, but we found a major error. April 1 is the trigger date. January 1 is another trigger date. The problem is that when you have a mass amount of product in a marketplace, you cannot adjust the label so that they change automatically. It's not like the Hogwarts school or something where all of a sudden magically you can change a label. So there has to be a transition time. And what this bill does is allow for a transition time where the 10-cent label can gradually come in and come in prior to April 1, but it will still be 5-cent redemption value. April 1, it all triggers to 10 cents, but the 5-cent label can stay in the marketplace for a significant period of time afterwards, because there are a lot of products like water, frankly, like some of the high-end beers, high alcohol beers that will have a longer shelf life, and they might be in the market for a long period of time. Your mass-produced product will go quickly, usually, but it's the more esoteric stuff that'll run into problems. This bill simply, that's all it does, is just give us the flexibility that the OLCC wanted to do by just an agreement with the industry. They were very good about that. but we would feel a little more comfortable with actual legislation saying what it is. That's all the bill does. Thank you.
Committee, have any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm trying to parse this bill and understand it. If I read it correctly, and I probably don't, on April 1, if I bring something back for redemption, I get a dime.
Yes.
Okay. Can I follow up?
Follow up.
But I may have only paid a nickel for it.
Yes.
Okay. Whoever it is that's dealing with the float is taking a hit, at least for a while.
Mr. Chair,
can you kind of describe how this will work, and why this seems to work okay, and why I don't think we have a bunch of opponents coming in here because they have to come up with a nickel that they didn't collect.
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's one of the big issues. That happened, frankly, when the bottle bill first came into being, when you brought water into the bottle bill a few years ago. Whenever you start a system, you have a transition period. It's a risk, frankly, that the industry has to take to make the transition. There's a lot of people, I mean, some of you have seen the Seinfeld episode where Kramer and Newman, distributors were the only people that weren't laughing at that because, frankly, there are people that say, aha, this is 10 cents, this is 5 cents, I'm going to carry it across. Also, containers have become universal, so you'll find a Oregon refund container in Washington State or California or Idaho or any place. Those are all worth 10 cents here because you can't really distinguish. So it is a risk. We feel there'll probably be a lot of money going out of the pocket in the beginning. We don't know what that redemption rate will be. We know that Michigan State, the only other state that has a 10 cent deposit, has a 94% redemption rate. So we're trying to make it manageable. And it's the big $64,000 question, except it's more than $64,000.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I need to go through the rest of my questions.
Let them do the math.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to support the bill, but as you all know, I voted against this process for many years, and I was sorry to see that this didn't contain something that addressed the issue with the tsunami, as I've called it, of cans and bottles and now everything else coming out of Idaho into Oregon. But it's you guys in one way or another bearing that cost. All the other stuff is on the record about why I have opposed this bill, as it's rapidly become a recycling bill and not the bottle bill. And I feel bad about that. But that's another topic for another day. I'm going to support the bill because I think it's necessary to allow the transition, even though the program itself has huge holes in it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, in spite of what has been stated in some articles periodically, we opposed the 10 cent deposit for a long, long time and basically got to the point where opposition became futile. And we ended up going with it. We have a lot of fears, but one of the reasons that we set up the cooperative was to try and, in effect, if you pardon the word, socialize the cost of the system throughout the entire system so no one area takes the gigantic hit. We think that with the co-op that's been set up, it minimizes the impact as much as possible. So it's just something we're going to have to live with. We understand your concerns, and sometimes we just have to live with the reality out there.
Further questions from the committee?
Just a comment.
Representative Reske.
Thank you. The fact that you've referenced both Seinfeld and Star Trek The Next Generation, I'm very impressed. So.
And Hogwarts. You know.
Mm-hmm. Hogwarts, yeah.
That's right. That's
and Hogwarts. Right. Hogwarts. Right. It happened to your wand.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I did. Yeah. That's why there's nine of them.
At this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill. There are no other persons signed up to testify. So I'm closing the public hearing, and I'm also going to call a brief recess. Okay. open a work session on House Bill 2746.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2746 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2746 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so the record is clear, I support the original model bill. What I have opposed over the years is its expansion to include this vast array of additional items. So I want that to be clear. And I've been pretty, and I've also been very, very unhappy with the before the restructuring and even now with the situation on these borders, because this whole system is so subject to fraud, it's just an embarrassment. And I go down and see Idaho cars parked in all kinds of places unloading haystacks of cans and bottles and soon to be everything else, and it seems to be a mockery of the system. But I want the record clear, the original bottle bill was an incredibly clever idea, mm-hmm. and very good for the state. Its evolution has been unpleasant to watch.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with my colleague, Governor McCall, and bottle bill, and it's been a fantastic process for Oregon. It's really taken the lead in the nation. As a fellow district that borders California, I also am concerned about the possibility of fraud, if you will,
border people here, don't we?
That could occur. So I just wanted that on record. We need to do something. There needs to be a transition, this is it.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too support the bill. I think it's needful to provide the kind of just stability and certainty of the marketplace that needs to be out there. But I do want to also sound the alarm about that tsunami that is coming when the expansion happens. And I don't think, I'm confident that we're not going to be ready for that. And I do have a bill that will address that issue and try to make sure that, again, we provide stability and we look out for the welfare of consumers and so forth. And we can do that in an orderly way, too, that makes sense. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any further comment? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the concerns, but also, you know, want to recognize the great impact that the bottle bill has had on cleaning up our beaches, cleaning up our roadsides, and you know, it's really been a successful model for the nation, and you know, I'm sure we'll be able to work through some of these issues as they come up. So, fully support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. I'll make one comment to wrap up. It's come to my attention through speaking with other knowledgeable parties that, due to the national and international orientation of some of the companies that provide more stable beverages into the state, like water, they've already gone ahead and started changing their labels. And so it may be that bottles of water, for example, that say they have a redemption value of 10 cents will be showing up soon. And those beverage containers will still only be worth 5 cents before April 1st, and then, of course, they'll be 10 cents afterwards. And it will be up to the vendors, the grocery retailers, and everybody else that sells those products to help inform their customers that's going to be the way it is through information. There's no contractual obligation that the retailers are under simply because the labels have changed. So with that, is there any further discussion before I move to vote?
Okay.
Seeing none, we'll have the clerk call the roll on this.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Bloom?
Excused.
Representative Foley?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard?
Aye.
Chair Holm?
Aye. The motion passes. And I'm happy to see committee that our first vote on a bill It was unanimous.
Sort of.
I'm going to ask, unless anybody feels super strongly, I'm going to ask Representative Leinger to carry this on the floor. Committee, I think our final bill of the day will be public hearing on House Bill 2268. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. And Abby, do you want to come forward? And Mike, come on. And forgive me for not trying either one of your last names right now. You can, maybe I'll, next time you're here, I'll be studied up on it. Go right ahead when ready.
Well, thank you, Chair Helm, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Abby Baduras. I'm a legislative analyst with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here today to describe the DEQ underground storage tank program and in support of House Bill 2268. With me here is Mike Kortenoff. Mike is the manager of the regional, the DEQ regional underground storage tank inspection program, or as many people call it, the UST program. A bit, and Mike will be here to answer some questions at the end if you have them. A bit of background before we discuss the bill. Generally, underground storage tanks, or USTs, are where local gas stations store the fuel. So to give you kind of a concept of what we're talking about. And until the mid-80s, USTs were made of bare steel, which is likely to corrode over time and allow the contents to leak into the environment. Faulty installation or inadequate operation and maintenance can also cause the contents to release into the environment. And really the greatest risk from leaking tanks is groundwater and releasing the contents into the environment. That can seep into the soil. Over half of Oregonians rely on groundwater for their drinking water. A leaking US can also prevent health and environmental risk from explosion or fire. In the late 80s, both federal and state laws were passed requiring owners to upgrade their tanks in response to that problem of petroleum leaks to groundwater. The DEQ program started in 1986 with a primary purpose that leaks do not, of ensuring that leaks do not occur in the over 1,800 facilities in Oregon subject to these laws. We do this by verifying proper operation of leak prevention equipment, such as and corrosion protection equipment, spill and overflow protection, and leak detection systems. To pay for the program, the statute required a per-tank fee. The legislature last increased that per-tank fee from $85 a tank to $135 a tank in 2007. Today, the UST program is unable to comply with our EPA-required compliance inspections, and we're also unable to revise our Oregon rules to align with EPA rules due to inadequate funding. The program can no longer afford two of our 5.5 full-time equivalent inspector positions needed to implement this program. So HB 2268, it was actually drafted last summer, and proposes actually the bill as introduced a new fee model based on total capacity of all the underground storage tanks at one site. But since that time, DEQ, we've been working with our stakeholders, some of which I think you'll hear from today. We've worked together, and we've proposed an amendment to 2268, and that you should see that on OLIS as well as in the fact sheet that is posted on OLIS, which continues the existing per-tank fee model as opposed to this new capacity-based model. And it would raise the per-tank fee from $135 to $325, phased in over 4 years, starting in 2018. And I'm pleased to report that we have agreement from all the stakeholders that we're aware of on this new model. The fees will pay for over half of the program costs, with federal grants paying for about 45%. DEQ uses no general fund for this work. The proposed fee will allow DEQ to restore the inspector positions, the two, and an analyst position to support additional program work due to the EPA requirements in the federal rules. It will allow the inspectors to continue the prevention activities that are really the basis of this program. Those activities really are inspecting each business to verify proper operation of the equipment, providing substantial technical assistance to ensure proper functioning of the systems, and in verifying that owners have the proper financial assurance in place to clean up contamination and help them stay in business if a leak does occur. So House Bill 2268, with the amendment, would allow DEQ to continue preventing and minimizing leaks to air, water, and land from these tanks. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here in support of the bill, and Mike and I are happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Committee questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm looking frantically. What is the definition of an underground storage tank for the purpose of this fee? I don't think you mean every tank in the world. I think you mean something smaller than that, but I don't know that.
For the record, my name is Mike Kortenhoff, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the tanks are specifically defined as petroleum-containing tanks and other hazardous substances. There are exemptions to that definition, though, that exclude home heating oil tanks is the main one, small farm tanks. So it is most tanks, but there's exemptions for large numbers of very small tanks.
Thank you. Could I follow up? I think the definition, I just found it, is the application in ORS 466.710, which I think describes all of that. It's a little bit confusing because the bill and the statute that's referenced in the bill don't actually define what an underground tank is. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, Representative Power.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can explain to us what percentage, if any, this includes residential underground storage tanks, or is it only commercial operations that this would apply to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Power, this is almost entirely commercial tanks, almost entirely gasoline stations, as we know them, fueling our cars. Home heating oil tanks, the vast majority of residential tanks are exempt, and I'm not recalling any. If a residence had a very large gasoline tank that they were using for their fueling their own fuel, their vehicles, farms sometimes do that, they would be regulated, but I'm not aware of any in Oregon.
Can I just follow up? So can you briefly, if possible, just explain what the EPA rules that we need to be in compliance with by September 2018 require of these folks that's different than what's currently required?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Power, the EPA rules and the Oregon rules are almost identical. The rules are patterned after each other. The rules have been recently modified to incorporate by EPA. The federal EPA promulgated these rules originally in the 80s. They have not made a major revision of the rules until just recently. And they made changes that actually brought it more into conformance with Oregon rules. And so the changes that we're making are closer to housekeeping changes regarding the changes from federal to the Oregon rules. But we still have to make modifications to the rules.
Representative Benton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The number of tanks, A and the B.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benton, there's 1,850 facilities that have underground storage tanks, and there's about 5,000 tanks combined on those facilities. Most facilities have two or three tanks in the ground, so 5,000 tanks.
Follow up. So the increase annually as opposed to the per tank amount, can you just give us that for A, B, C, and D?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, Is the question of what's the phase-in amount?
Yeah, sure. The question is, how much money does this bill raise each year over the next 4 years?
So, Representative Bence, I don't have that broken down by year in front of me, but I'm very happy to send that to you.
Follow-up. So a round number, $500,000, $50 million. I mean, how much does this bill raise in general?
Yeah.
I apologize. I will have to get that to you.
Thank you. One last question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So what it says is, if we don't do this, we will lose part of the leaking underground storage tank grant funding. I don't know what part means. Half? A third? 10%? I mean, I just need to know what risk we're taking by not doing this, because that appears to be the risk. I mean, there may be more risk. I mean, I don't want underground tanks leaking, but I also am interested in seeing, it seems that we're taking this group of people and saying, you're going to pay this great big pile of money, we don't know how much yet, and take care of this, all of our collective program. And part of that also includes cleaning up and inspections. So I'm just trying to see why we're imposing this obligation upon this group of people and why it makes sense.
Chair Helm, Representative Bence, I think there's two or three questions in there. I'm not sure if I quite have them all. The first risk is of increased leaks, and Mike might have handy the data. When you go from every three-year inspections to every five-year inspections, the compliance rates and risk goes way up. So that is part of the answer. Another part of the answer is how much EPA funding could we lose if we no longer meet the 1 in 3 year inspection rate? We're close to 1 in 5 now. About 45% of our funding for the program is federal grants now. We don't know what they will do if we don't meet the requirement. That will be a negotiation. We negotiate every year with them. I can't tell you the answer to that.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you for that. Those are good answers. I just needed to know if this group of people, this 185, no, it's more than that. It's 5,000 total tanks, and how many owners?
1,800 facilities.
1,800.
150, I think.
And so we are imposing this financial obligation on these 1,800 facilities. The inspection part, I understand the need. I was just wondering if the money raised is being used for cleanups that have nothing to do with them, or is this limited to just those people who are paying into the program?
So, Chair Helm, Representative Bence, the per tank fee goes to the underground storage tank inspection and compliance program. There is separate funding and a separate program that handles our leaking underground storage tank program, or as we call it, the LUST program. And I don't know if what Mike wants to add.
No, nothing yet.
Thank you. I got information from Mr. Mason in the back here about policy option package 132 would raise $1.7 million in other fund from the fee in total revenue. And I would still have to divide it up in the each year for you. I can get that to you.
Thank you. Good.
Further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You referenced stakeholders who are in agreement with this. Who would those be? I mean, I'm assuming the station owners, correct?
So I believe signed in to testify are the Grocers and Oregon Fuels Association, so you can hear from them.
Okay. Follow-up. So the income raised, this stays within the inspection department then, correct?
Representative Johnson, Chair Helm, yes, it is for the underground storage tank compliance and inspection program, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll invite Amanda and Danelle forward.
Oh, boy. That's a good thing to do with money.
Welcome.
Do you want me to go first? Chair Helm, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocers Association. Okay, yeah. I brought my laptop in case there's more tough questions. While you rarely see us here before you advocating on behalf of a fee increase, we work pretty closely with DEQ on their undergrounds, George Tank. Our members do represent a vast majority of the larger stations. Our average store has about 2 to 4 underground stations or tanks, so that's where that per tank fee charge comes in. We operate across the state of Oregon, as I said, with about an average of 3 tanks. Right now we're paying about $135 per tank, so our average fee is about $405. As staff mentioned, they're not required to inspect annually. It's actually on a rotation basis, so we pay that annually, but we're inspected once every 3 years. We're committed to support the goals of the DEQ tank program as it relates to the general protection of health and environment. To Representative Benz's points earlier, there is benefit for us, which is why we spent all summer working with DEQ to kind of get this right, to make sure that we have a state program with a single set of requirements that eliminates the duplication that results from separate state and federal requirements, as well as inspections, as well as fees. And so we're willing to sit before you today and support the fee increase before you. We believe the per tank fee basis is better than the original proposal of the capacity fee basis, which would have charged our members upwards of about $2,000 a year. So we think the proposal before you has made significant movement, and we are greatly appreciative of DEQ staff for that.
Chair Hellman, members of the committee, for the record, Danelle Romaine representing the Oregon Fuels Association. And the Oregon Fuels Association is a statewide association. We have about 125 members. We represent both fuel distributors and retailers. We have about 65% of the transportation fuels in the state. And we were very pleased with how the DEQ approached us on this issue. Obviously, like the grocers, we're not a quick group to just say yes to a new fee increase. It's hard to keep a gas station in business these days, but the DEQ was very proactive in coming to us this summer with a series of proposals. We sent them back and forth with our members. We finally got to this phased-in approach, which makes it a lot easier for especially a smaller station to justify a new fee. This obviously goes to a very important environmental program that we support, and we're in full support of the bill with the -1 amendment.
Any questions?
Just one. There's a benefit to having these tanks tested, because nobody wants to have their tanks leaking and then be liable for that disaster. Is that one of the reasons you're happy for this continued oversight? That the actual coming out by the DEQ and checking is actually a benefit to those owning the tanks, as opposed to, I mean, I'm just curious what the good is that comes up these inspections.
Chair Helm, Rep Benz, this is a federal requirement by the EPA. So if the DEQ wasn't doing this work, the EPA would come into the state to do it. We, as a group, went back and decided that we'd rather work with the Oregon DEQ, our local agency, on this issue rather than the unknown of the EPA. And that's really how we came to the decision.
And Chair Helm, Representative Benz, so we, Northwest Grocers, also represents Washington and Idaho. We've had the same discussion in both states. Idaho just did a small increase last year. Washington did it about 2 years ago. And both of those states have also chosen to implement their own program and do their inspections versus having the EPA come in.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up. Forgive me. Well, the point I'm trying to get at here, the inspections benefit the owners. That's what I'm trying to say. If you have a service station, you want to know if you have a leak. Mm-hmm. And if these people come out and do the inspection, they'll tell you. Because a leak is going to destroy you financially, mm-hmm. destroy you. So what I'm trying to say is these inspections are good things, I think. That's what I'm asking mm-hmm. you. Not just that this is the cheapest way to get away with it. So these inspections do you some good. So I can go home and say, once again, yes, I voted for this fee, but it benefited those folks. Not because it was less expensive than the EPA, but they actually checked the thing and told us if it was leaking. That's my question.
Chair Helm, Rep. Yes. Benz, we agree with that. Yes, they are good, and that's why we support this.
Thank you for that.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, just a quick question. The further my colleague goes with this, the more my mind works. But I guess, is there any recourse if, in fact, you got a clean bill of health, but then subsequent to that it was discovered that actually the inspection wasn't as thorough as it could have been? Is there any recourse for the agency, i.e. you might have incurred some leaking that should have been detected, but something was amiss in the process or procedure, it wasn't quite thorough? You understand what I'm saying? So that you end up with a situation like this where you get leaking going on, but you were given a clean bill of health 6 months ago.
Rep. Helm, or Chair Helm, Rep. Johnson, are you saying that if the agency didn't do a good enough inspection,
correct,
what is the
so
recourse for us?
They got your money, performed the inspection, but were found that maybe it was incomplete or somebody just missed something.
Yeah. Palmer, can you come on up? Or
could have been an act of God.
Are there any person
that wants to from...
Okay.
I'm pretty sure a leak is an act of God.
What kind of bond does a DEQ have for... See what I'm getting
there? Yeah, I do.
So for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, to answer your question, I think one thing to bear in mind about this is that the tank owners have to have financial responsibility, so they carry insurance to help cover these kind of instances. But it, so that will help. But if your question is in somehow DEQ and doing our inspection missed something or didn't follow the proper protocol, I don't think, but I'd like to check with DOJ that there is a recourse to the tank owner for that. You know, generally the state is immune from liability for ministerial, administrative type actions like that. So I'd like to run that by DOJ, and if I'm not right about that, I'll come report back to the committee. But I don't think so. But again, that is part of the reason for having financial responsibility, so that in the event there is a spill, whether it's a bad inspection or just because, as Representative Benz indicated, tanks occasionally leak, that there is a ability to clean up mm-hmm. whatever mess results from that.
Mm-hmm. Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, I'll just add that these systems have pretty exhaustive internal checks and balances, so our sites are we're personally checking each of our stations on a regular basis. It's not just a reliance on when the DEQ comes out, just to give you that sense that they're almost immediately triggered any time there's a leak. We don't necessarily wait for the inspection to come out.
Okay. I guess I would just add, I guess I'm a little surprised that, and maybe it's because the EPA is involved and not just DEQ, but that there aren't some kind of third-party certification processes like this, i.e., I would put it regarding septic tanks. You know, folks that do septic tank pumping and maintenance can certify those tanks, and you don't have to have your local sanitation department do anything at all. They're licensed, they're testing, you know, they go through all the hoops to be certified by the state. They do that. Mm-hmm. Your government employee doesn't have to get involved at all. It's a private sector service.
If I might, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, I'm looking at the staff and they're indicating there are services that are provided like that. I think the issue for DEQ is in order to meet the federal delegation, we have to make a certain number of inspections from a regulatory point of view, and that's our charge. But, yeah, there are private contractors and service providers who do this kind of inspection work for the benefit of the owner.
Yeah. Thank you.
And licensure, yes. Thanks.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Those are all the folks that I have signed up to testify on House Bill 2268. Anything for the... I'm going to close this public hearing. Anything for the good of the order committee?
Do you want to talk about next week?
Next, yes.
Joint.
Representative Johnson has asked what we will be doing next. On Monday, our next meeting, we'll be having a joint meeting of the House Energy Environment Committee and the Senate Natural Resources and Environment Committee to hear informational hearing on the DEQ report on carbon pricing systems, a PSU report on carbon tax, which some of us, I think, heard before in 2015 or 2016 when PSU finished the study, and a report from OSU on climate change as well. And it's a purely an informational hearing. And then stay tuned after that for Wednesday's agenda, which is not set yet.
Okay.
Thank you. The House Energy and Environment Committee is adjourned.
Reminder, we're going to be here.
Committee is adjourned.
Reminder, we're going to be here.
The House Energy and Environment